Hello and welcome back to the In Focus podcast. I'm Philippa Lamb. This time, we're looking at how changes to British farming could negatively affect the UK's broader economic resilience. By the end of 2027, following Brexit, British farms will stop benefiting from the EU Common Agricultural Policy. Now, that policy paid subsidies largely regardless of land use. But now, instead, farmers will need to transition to new schemes established by the UK's devolved administrations. These schemes, which aim to strengthen sustainability, require farms to meet environmental objectives in areas such as hedge management, rewilding, and tree planting. But critics are worried that those incentives will undermine output and the sector's ability to respond effectively to market shocks. As we know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has raised serious questions about food security. So can the UK really afford such a drastic rethink on food production? To tell us more about this, we're joined by two experts. David Misson is a consultant at Norfolk accountants Larkin Gowan, and Roseanne Bennett is a partner at Greaves Western Air, based in Northumberland and East Lothian. Thanks for coming in, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, not everyone listening is going to be familiar with the farming sector. Can you just briefly set out for us a sense of the size of the sector and the players in it?
One overuses the word unique, but it is a unique sector. It covers something like 80% of the UK landmass. There are, in England, which is the easiest one to look at, about 100,000 farmers, farm holdings. But when you boil it down to get to the ones which are providing a living, there are about 40,000. And that 40,000 are farming about 90% of the whole farmed area. So there are two-thirds of them, if you like, are on quite small holdings. They've perhaps got another job, or perhaps the land's been let out, but they've still got the holding. But there are only about 40,000 active farmers, and they are farming, on average, about 525 acres each.
And this is still mostly family managed?
That's the second identifying factor about farming. For such a big physical part of the UK economy, it is run primarily by family farming partnerships. There are a few big players. There are a few, particularly at the front end of the vegetable and fruit markets, there are one or two bigger players. But if you took the average farming enterprise, it would be about 500 acres with probably one or maybe two generations and one employee. That is the other thing. Something like two-thirds of those involved in the farming industry are owners. They're either self-employed or directors of farming companies.
And just as we came into the studio, you were saying to me the production cycle is the other thing that makes it unique.
Absolutely. If you look at the moment, as you drive around and where they're now starting to come through the floods, you will see crops that are in the fields. They would have been planted in August, perhaps. They will grow through until next July. They'll be harvested. They may not be sold until January, February time. So you've got something like a 15 to 18 month production cycle. A farming business has a working capital of about 150% of its turnover. And Roseanne will probably elaborate on this, but on the livestock side, it's similar.
So I suppose my question then would be, how profitable are most of these holdings?
It depends. I suppose what we've seen is this huge volatility in these agricultural businesses. If we go to 2022, the arable farms were making huge profits. But then when we go into 2023, there's huge losses. There's peaks and troughs, and it's a really difficult business to manage. And because the cycle is so long, like David was saying, when you plant that grain in the ground, what are you actually going to sell it for? You don't actually know. Some people will hedge it and sell some of it forward, but you are in the dark, really.
So you depend on commodity prices.
Well, commodity prices, weather, disease, international factors. It's not defined by UK prices. It's defined by world prices.
And is it fair to say the bulk of profit has come from subsidies then so far?
I think if you look at the bottom line profit, yes, it is the biggest single component. It's a smaller part of the turnover, but you have to incur the costs anyway. So yes, there are some horrendous figures for what might happen when the subsidy is fully withdrawn, based on a lowish run of profits in the 10 years ago, I suppose it was.
And that goes with arable and livestock farming.
Yeah, I think if you look at people's bottom lines, if you remove the basic payment support pre-2022, where we had extraordinary commodity prices, you would be making a loss. So it has filled a huge gap.
OK, so subsidies, a crucial foundation of the entire sector. They're changing, as I said, now we're no longer part of Europe. What are the key differences?
Can I just go back a little stage here? Subsidies have been within the UK farming sector since about 1947. Post-war, the NFU and the government sat down and decided they really didn't want to be short of food again. So there have been different types. We've had deficiency payments just after the war, where they decided jointly between the two sides what a farm should be making, and then the government made up the deficiency. So people actually took in their corn sales invoices and got a payment. We then moved into intervention, where the government bought grain in the markets to keep the prices up, so farmers had an income from it. We then went into the EU, and we had intervention in the early years there, and it moved on to flat rate payments. Having discovered that intervention led to wine lakes and butter mountains, they then backed off a bit. And the tail end of the EU subsidies were a mixture of area-based payments, where people received a subsidy just for farming the land in accordance with reasonably good environmental standards. And there were also some add-on environmental subsidies that came on top of it. What we are seeing now is that structure is being phased out over a seven-year period, and we're halfway through that now. And it is being replaced by wholly environmental subsidies. And just looking at the sort of things we've got, nectar flower mix, so planting grass and butterflies, basically, skylark plots, overwintered stubble, lapwing plots, flower-rich margins, wild bird food.
So these are the commercial choices that farmers would be rewarded for with subsidies.
Yes, and it's a very nuanced picture, because in some areas, on very poor land, it is probably economically better to grow wildflowers or bird cover than to try and get an arable crop off it. Sorry, I should have mentioned I actually farm myself in a small way.
Okay.
So that makes it a bit more relevant. But that was almost the first thing we did, was to get the yield readings off the combine, work out where it was really not worth growing a crop, and use that to grow environmental crops. We could do that under the old system. Okay. Under the new system, that is all you can do.
So it's entirely driven by these sustainable objectives?
Pretty much, yes.
So in the past, you've got a payment per acre, regardless of what you've done. But now it is you have to do something to do that from an environmental point of view. And this is what it's about. It's about public goods for a public benefit.
That is the mantra, actually, yeah. Public goods for public money.
And it's not about food production per se. It's more about, you know, soil, improved soil as an outcome. Improved water is the outcome rather than we are producing more food.
So food production is not seen as the public good in this context?
No, it's not.
In the English policy, it's not. If you look at the Scottish policy, food security is mentioned. So there is some mention to it, but in the English policy, we are going away from that because it's the public benefit, making it sustainable, more environmental.
I mean, as you say, these are devolved matters, so Scotland and Wales will have their own systems. But take-up has been very slow, hasn't it? Farmers have not been keen.
It was interesting. When the Prime Minister spoke to the NFU last week, he mentioned that almost 50% of farmers had taken new contracts. Well, reversing that, that means that over 50%
were still relying
on the fallback of the old contracts. Now, we have had a couple of good years, as I think Roseanne said earlier, so that has maybe taken the pressure off. But it is quite alarming that so few have actually taken up these new schemes.
So what are their reservations then? Why aren't they taking them up?
So when the schemes first came out, the payment rates were quite low and the information surrounding it was quite vague. I think there's been a lot of work done, so it's clearer now. The payment rates are a lot clearer and you are seeing... I'm seeing more interest from my clients in the uptake of it.
But they are being driven now.
They are being driven
by the falling prices.
Yeah.
I mean, probably another thing we should have explained earlier on, the livestock and the arable sectors almost work against each other. So if arable prices go low, animal feed is cheap, profits are higher on the livestock. Conversely, if arable prices are high, livestock is squeezed. And we have actually seen, at the moment, livestock's on a bit of a roll. The sheep and cattle prices are quite good. Arable prices are down to way below where they were pre-Ukraine. So different sectors are suffering in different ways. But the gist is, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years, there has been proper money and good profits made in some parts, not always the same part at the same time. And that has therefore taken away the imperative to do something about these falling subsidies.
And I think there's the realisation of farmers that the basic payment scheme is going,
yes.
And they're actually seeing their payments going down. So they are saying, what are we going to do to fill that gap?
So there's been understandable caution while farmers got their heads around it and perhaps a bit of a communication issue and some tweaking to be done. But is your general sense then that farmers will sign up in greater numbers?
Yes, I would say definitely.
I don't think
they'll have a choice. No. Yeah.
And, I mean, just to be clear, do you feel these schemes work well for farmers financially?
Do I think they work well? In terms of it takes some of the risk out of their business because you can guarantee your payment for things that you are doing, I think it'll make some farmers who are struggling to actually think, is it better using more of these schemes, taking more out of production because it reduces the risk for their business? You're not open to the weather, you crop failure, and obviously labour shortages on farms are a key area. So if you are struggling with labour and you can put some more of your land into schemes, is that possibly what they're going to do? And I think they were. Farmers are thinking, what are they going to do? And I think they will become more popular.
So one of the other objectives of the scheme, I think, was to make sure that larger landowners weren't favoured over smaller holders. Is that right?
I think that was the hope, wasn't it? You were de-linking what you received to the land you actually had. But there'll be no, the outcome will be no different, because if you own a lot of land, you will naturally have more hedges. So, and you have the more ability to claim.
And there is a danger as well, which is that some of the larger landowners, particularly where they've got tenants and a tenancy comes up, they may look and say, well, why do I need to re-let this land? I can actually take it all in hand, put it down to grass and flowers, and not have to worry with a tenant in future.
So will we see, well, I suppose two questions. Will we see more consolidation, and will we see just smaller farmers dropping out of farming altogether?
Possibly. Consolidation's been going on, but it's been going on much more slowly than people think. The number of farms dropped something like 1% in the last 5 years.
It's not as significant, actually.
No, but then we've had some quite good years recently.
Okay.
And something you might also see is, especially for livestock farmers who are renting, say, the next door farm to make their unit more viable, that person might be putting their farm down to schemes now. The landowner might go, actually, I don't want your sheep on my land anymore. Yeah. And I think it will cause issues across.
But generally, for this 40,000 farmers, they own, half of those own their own land, about half owner occupied, and the other half is a mixture of tenancies and part and part. I don't see them selling it. It's the last thing any farmer wants to do is sell the land. They have a generation after generation sitting on their shoulder watching them, and they don't want to be the one to sell up on my watch.
David, I mean, looking ahead a few years, once this transition is complete, what outcomes do you see for farming and indeed for food production?
Well, food production will be lower.
Land will be taken out of production.
I come back to my own example that we've already taken out the very marginal land. There were some bits that really weren't worth cultivating. There's one field left, which is going out next year, and it's going into a mixture of grass and wildflowers. Now, as a short-term measure, that's fine. It's a three-year contract, and at the end of it, if the wheat price has gone up, we can put it back into wheat, and it will have had a nice rest. But the consequence is that it must reduce the food productivity of the country. And some of these, as I say, they're three-year schemes. It's just putting it into grass. You can easily take it out. Others, the Welsh tree planting, for example, almost irreversible, because once you've planted a field full of trees, it's quite difficult to get rid of them. Or indeed the rewilding, where you just let scrub take over. So I can't see any way that they're not going to reduce the food producing capability of the country.
And I think we're already naturally seeing reduction, especially in the beef and sheep industry, in terms of numbers of livestock. And I think that will continue, because we have an ageing demographic of farmers, and the people you worked with livestock, there aren't as many of them. So I think it's just a natural reduction, decline we'll see, because a lot of the schemes we're seeing is that they're promoting low input grass, which means they'll carry less stock. So I think you naturally see a reduction in the herd and flocks as we go into the scheme.
And are trade agreements with overseas countries playing into that as well?
I think they're more perception than reality at the moment, because it still costs quite a lot of money to get sheep here from New Zealand. But they are certainly creating an air of uncertainty. I think that is true. Farmers are looking over their shoulder and saying, well, these agreements are coming. Is it worth investing in new buildings, new machinery, when we know we're going to be overcut by countries that can produce meat more cheaply than we can?
And that's a significant matter, isn't it? The wariness about investing. Because as you say, with such a long production cycle, these decisions can't be reversed on a whim.
No.
And investing, particularly at this uncertain time.
There is another angle to this, which is the livestock welfare side, because our livestock welfare standards are world-beating at the moment. The concern is that the shopper is not actually quite so bothered as to where their meat comes from and how well it's been looked after. So, and they do tend to go on price. So there is a concern there that we're sucking in, not only we're sucking in cheaper imports, but they are less of a lower quality.
Well, the other question here is about how farming would respond to a market shock under those circumstances, isn't it? Say, for example, an expansion of Russian aggression or some event that we haven't likely thought about yet, like another pandemic. That's going to be the difficulty, isn't it? Lack of agility?
That's got to be a consequence. I mean, it is a very, you know, it is an oil tanker to turn round farming. But you cannot, as I say, dig up a forest and put it back to arable quickly. And it happened in the war. I mean, it took 2 or 3 years for the war ag committees to actually get UK production out from the slump of the 30s into the productivity it was running on by 1947.
It does feel quite counterintuitive, doesn't it, to potentially reduce food production and resilience at a time of global instability and indeed, as you say, volatile commodity prices. I mean, I'm wondering quite how we've arrived in this place. Am I right in thinking the schemes were conceived before the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Long before that. 2018.
Okay, so before the pandemic as well. But is that part of the reason that these things were just not thought through, perhaps quite as much as they should?
I think they were produced at a time when we had plenty of cheap food worldwide, so we knew we could import whatever we needed. There is a growing green lobby wanting to improve the environment, and the government was elected on the basis of leaving our soil, water and air in better condition than they did when they came.
Which is obviously an objective everyone would get behind.
Including farmers.
Yeah.
But it does feel at times we're just exporting the issue, aren't we? How food is produced abroad. We're reducing the food production in this country. We're shifting it across to other countries. So Brazil, there's more of our meat going to come from Brazil, which, you know, is less sustainable if they're chopping down the Amazon rainforest to produce it.
You've just taken my line. I was just about to say, you could look at the sugar industry. Yeah. We've got probably the most efficient sugar beet production in Europe, certainly. But we cannot compete with somebody who is chopping down rainforest and burning it to grow sugarcane in South America.
So what's the answer here? I mean, sustainability can't be postponed forever, can it?
No, but we seem to be running way ahead of the rest of the world on this one. We are, if you like, setting examples, but we are relying on the kindness of others to provide our food if things get sticky.
And if you look at what's happening in Europe, there's been a lot of demonstrations in Europe because they to become more green, their farming. And they've actually stepped back on some of the green initiatives that they wanted to put in place because the farmers literally just were not happy.
It's the same thing, but the European farmers are a little bit more vocal than British farmers.
And their objections were, what about profitability?
Yeah, and there was initiatives to reduce uses of insecticide, pesticides, reduced to make it more environmentally friendly. And they've had to step back on some of those things. And they still get direct payments in Europe. And I don't think there's any sign that they will cease direct payments. So we are at the forefront of something completely different.
So what needs to happen here then? Because from what you're saying, it's unlikely we're going to see much change in the English and Welsh systems, is it? Or will we? Because the Scottish system hasn't been announced yet, is that right?
There's the broad framework for it, but there's not the payments, what people are going to receive or an actual scheme yet. You will still see direct payments in Scotland. They have said that they want to be more aligned with what's happening in Europe.
So they might not be quite so driven by sustainability then?
From what they are saying, the indications are that there will be direct payments for per land like we have now.
Okay.
So I think England and Wales are taking it to another extreme.
What needs to happen, David?
The government or DEFRA need to get farmers back on side and they need to actively encourage them to produce food. There has to be an option in here somewhere to encourage efficient production of food. And that is the one thing that's absent. There is nothing in here to say grow food. It's grow other things and grow. And everybody, don't get me wrong. I think people are very happy to grow other things. They're happy to grow other things on the marginal land. They're happy to be paid to keep their hedges looking nice and thicken up and maybe plant new hedges. They're happy to be able to look after their ponds and little bits of wildlife. In the first version of the new scheme, that was pretty much what it covered. There was an option. They looked their outcomes rather than methods. And said you needed to provide so much tall nest and cover, so many rough places. And of course, most farms had those. So it was quite easy. You could look around and say, yes, we've got that, we've got that, we've got that. We need to do a little bit of this, but we can get most of our subsidy money without doing anything very different from what we are doing now.
So what happened to that scheme?
I don't know, but it was a shame because that was a good scheme. And it then moved to, I think we're on version 3 of the Sustainable Farming Incentive now, which has moved away from that and it's very much focused on actions rather than results.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because even some like myself, not involved in this sector, you know, I had heard the former president of the NFU, Minette Batters, talking about food sustainability and the dangers that we're running into for a considerable period of time. This is not new criticism. And yet, here we are. How has that happened?
I think if you look at the government, they think this is a good thing and they think this will make farming more sustainable. But if you're dealing with volatile commodity prices and you've got these attractive payment rates to put your food into non-productive land, you will do it. And they still think people will be productive, and some farmers will be, but those farmers who are possibly, they've got shortage of labour, working capital requirements, this takes out some of the risk in their business. So I think it will drive behaviours that maybe the government weren't expecting.
I'm sure it will. I think they may be more productive on smaller acreages, because that is what will happen. Some of the marginal land will just go out of production altogether and into environmental schemes. So there will be, but what is being lost in food production for the marginal land won't be made up for greater productivity on the better land. I think that is the consequence.
And is this the route we're on now? Is there no means of changing it at this stage?
Not unless world commodity prices get a lot higher. And that will turn it. With wheat at £155 a tonne or whatever it is at the moment, it is actually better to grow wildflowers. Harvest your butterflies. If wheat goes up to £250-260 a tonne, no, we're not worried about the butterflies. We'll crop the less well-yielding land.
But as we know, commodity prices come and go, don't
and
they?
We've seen this in the past where people, farmers could have set aside and they got paid for it and you could choose, it was optional and it depended on what was happening with the price of commodities. They might not have set aside if they didn't have to. It really is at the whims. Farmers will do what makes them money. They are businesses after all.
And they are very good at it. A few years ago, there was a drought in the West Country where most of the livestock are. And East Anglia had quite a lot of surplus straw, which is normally just chopped up and ploughed in. And within weeks, all that straw had been baled up and put on wagons down to the West Country. Farms that had not had a baler on them for decades were harvesting that
baling straw. Baling up straw.
Because there was an opportunity there and they leapt into it and took it. So they are very adept at turning a penny where they can.
OK, two final pieces of advice then. Roseanne, what's your advice to farmers?
In terms of farmers, I think they do need to look at these schemes. Their basic payment is going. What I would say is look at them, not just the headline payment rates, look at the schemes, consider what's best for your business, because you will be signing up for 3 years. So even, you know, if commodity prices are good in 2 years, you can't just come out of the scheme quickly. You need to consider what you're doing, but I don't think they can be ignored anymore.
I would build onto that to say, actually, do a business plan. Because farmers, by and large, are notoriously bad at doing business plans. Any other business has a plan for the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years to know where they're going. I can hardly think of a single farm who has that written down. It's in there in their head, but and as you know, if it's not written down, it's not a plan. So
indeed. David, your advice for government?
Listen to what farmers are saying. They're really not trying to lift your leg on this one. It is, you know, there is a desperate need to maintain food security.
David, Roseanne, thanks so much for being with us. I think many of our listeners won't have been familiar with those questions. It's been really fascinating to hear about them.
Thank you.
If you'd like to dig into this subject or you work in the sector, why not join ICAW's farming and rural business community for events and newsletters covering practical, technical and strategic issues. Membership is open to all. You don't have to be an ICAW member, and you can find out more in the show notes attached to the episode. We'll be back in late April. Meantime, the Insight series, sharing news and developments from all corners of accountancy and ICAW, will be with you early next month. And finally, ICAW has launched a new podcast for everyone working in the tax sector. If you are a tax professional or you'd like to refresh your tax knowledge, the Tax Track has specialist analysis from the ICAW tax faculty, and you can listen on any podcast app or indeed at icaw.com/podcasts. Thanks for being with us today. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do subscribe to the series and never miss an episode. Thank you.